Chapter 160. Come to see him no more until he asks me. Why, my goodness. Apostrophe, ah. Apostrophe, apostrophe, says Mrs. Pipchin. It's a pity he hadn't a little more to do with mines. They'd have tried his temper for him. Apostrophe, and what, apostrophe, resumes Mrs. Chick, quite regardless of Mrs. Pipchin's observations, is it to end in? That's what I want to know. What does my brother mean to do? He must do something. It's of no use remaining shut up in his own rooms. Business won't come to him. No. He must go to it. Then why don't he go? He knows where to go, I suppose, having been a man of business all his life. Very good. Then why not go there? Apostrophe, apostrophe, Mrs. Chick, after forging this powerful chain of reasoning, remained silent for a minute to admire it. Besides, apostrophe, says the discreet lady, with an argumentative air, whoever heard of such obstinacy as his staying shut up here through all these dreadful disagreeables? It's not as if there was no place for him to go to. Of course he could have come to our house. He knows he is at home there, I suppose. Mr. Chick is perfectly bored about it, and I said with my own lips, why surely, Paul, you don't imagine that, because your affairs have got into this state, you are the less at home to such near relatives as ourselves? You don't imagine that we are like the rest of the world? But no, here he stays all through, and here he is. Why, good gracious me, suppose the house was to be let. What would he do then? He couldn't remain here then. If he attempted to do so, there would be an ejectment, an action for dough, and all sorts of things, and then he must go. Then why not go at first instead of at last? And that brings me back to what I said just now, and I naturally ask what is to be the end of it? Apostrophe, apostrophe, I know what's to be the end of it, as far as I am concerned, apostrophe, replies Mrs. Pipchin, and that's enough for me. I'm going to take myself off in a jiffy. Apostrophe, in a which, Mrs. Pipchin, apostrophe, says Mrs. Chick. In a jiffy, apostrophe, retorts Mrs. Pipchin sharply. Ah, well, really I can't blame you, Mrs. Pipchin, apostrophe, says Mrs. Chick, with frankness. It would be pretty much the same to me, if you could, apostrophe, replies the sardonic Pipchin. At any rate I'm going. I can't stop here. I should be dead in a week. I had to cook my own pork chop yesterday, and I'm not used to it. My constitution will be giving way next. Besides, I had a very fair connection at Brighton. When I came here, little Panky's folks alone were worth a good £80 a year to me, and I can't afford to throw it away. I've written to my niece, and she expects me by this time. Apostrophe, have you spoken to my brother? Apostrophe, apostrophe, inquires Mrs. Chick. Oh, yes, it's very easy to say speak to him, apostrophe, retorts Mrs. Pipchin. How is it done? I called out to him yesterday that I was no use here, and that he had better let me send for Mrs. Richards. He grunted something or other that meant yes, and I sent. Grunt indeed. If he had been Mr. Pipchin, he'd have had some reason to grunt. Yeah. I've no patience with it. Apostrophe, apostrophe, hear this exemplary female, who has pumped up so much fortitude and virtue from the depths of the Peruvian mines, rises from her cushioned property to see Mrs. Chick to the door. Mrs. Chick, deploring to the last the peculiar character of her brother, noiselessly retires, much occupied with her own sagacity and clearness of head. In the dusk of the evening Mr. Tootle, being off duty, arrives with Polly and a box, and leaves them, with a sounding kiss, in the hall of the empty house, the retired character of which affects Mr. Tootle's spirits strongly. I tell you what, Polly, me dear, apostrophe, says Mr. Tootle, being now an engine driver, and well-to-do in the world, I shouldn't allow of your coming here, to be made dull-like, if it weren't for favors past. But favors past, Polly, is never to be forgot. To them which is in adversity, besides, your face is a cord. So let's have another kiss on it, my dear. You wish no better than to do a right act, I know, and my views is that it's right and dutiful to do this. Good night, Polly. Mrs. Pipchin by this time looms dark in her black bombazine skirts, black bonnet, and shawl, and has her personal property packed up, and has her chair laid a favorite chair of Mr. Domney's, and the dead bargain of the sale ready near the street door, and is only waiting for a fly van, going tonight to Brighton on private service, which is to call for her, by private contract, and convey her home. Presently it comes. Mrs. Pipchin's wardrobe being handed in and stowed away, Mrs. Pipchin's chair is next handed in, and placed in a convenient corner among certain trusses of hay, it being the intention of the amiable woman to occupy the chair during her journey. Mrs. Pipchin herself is next handed in, and grimly takes her seat. There is a snaky gleam in her hard gray eye, as of anticipated rounds of buttered toast, relays of hot chops, worryings, and quellings of young children, sharp snappings at poor Barry, and all the other delights of her ogress's castle. Mrs. Pipchin almost laughs as the fly van drives off, and she composes her black bombazine skirts, and settles herself among the cushions of her easy chair. The house is such a ruin, that the rats have fled, and there is not one left. But Polly, though alone in the deserted mansion, for there is no companionship in the shut-up rooms in which its late master hides his head, is not alone long. It is night, and she is sitting at work in the housekeeper's room, trying to forget what a lonely house it is, and what a history belongs to it, when there is a knock at the hall door, as loud sounding as any knock can be, striking into such an empty place. Opening it, she returns across the echoing hall, accompanied by a female figure in a close black bonnet. It is Miss Tox, and Miss Tox's eyes are red. Oh, Polly, says Miss Tox, when I looked in to have a little lesson with the children just now, I got the message that you left for me, and as soon as I could recover my spirits at all, I came on after you. Is there no one here but you? Not a soul, says Polly. Have you seen him? Whispers Miss Tox. Bless you, returns Polly, no, he has not been seen this many a day. They tell me he never leaves his room. Is he said to be ill? Inquires Miss Tox. No, ma'am, not that I know of, returns Polly, except in his mind. He must be very bad there, poor gentleman. Miss Tox's sympathy is such that she can scarcely speak. She is no chicken, but she has not grown tough with age and celibacy. Her heart is very tender, her compassion very genuine, her homage very real. Beneath the locket with the fishy eye in it, Miss Tox bears better qualities than many a less whimsical outside, such qualities as will outlive, by many courses of the sun, the best outsides and brightest husks that fall in the harvest of the great reaper. It is long before Miss Tox goes away, and before Polly, with a candle flaring on the blank stairs, looks after her, for company, down the street, and feels unwilling to go back into the dreary house, and jar its emptiness with the heavy fastenings of the door, and glide away to bed. But all this Polly does, and in the morning sets in one of those darkened rooms such matters as she has been advised to prepare, and then retires, and enters them no more until next morning at the same hour. There are bells there, but they never ring, and though she can sometimes hear a footfall going to and fro, it never comes out. Miss Tox returns early in the day. It then begins to be Miss Tox's occupation to prepare little dainties, or what are such to her, to be carried into these rooms next morning. She derives so much satisfaction from the pursuit that she enters on it regularly from that time, and brings daily in her little basket various choice condiments selected from the scanty stores of the deceased owner of the powdered head and pigtail. She likewise brings, in sheets of curl paper, morsels of cold meats, tongues of sheep, halves of fowls, for her own dinner, and sharing these collations with Polly, passes the greater part of her time in the ruined house that the rats have fled from, hiding in a fright at every sound, stealing in and out like a criminal, only desiring to be true to the fallen object of her admiration, unknown to him, unknown to all the world, but one poor simple woman. The Major knows it, but no one is the wiser for that, though the Major is much the merrier. The Major, in a fit of curiosity, has charged the native to watch the house sometimes, and find out what becomes of Dombey. The native has reported Miss Tox's fidelity, and the Major has nearly choked himself dead with laughter. He is permanently bluer from that hour, and constantly wheezes to himself, his lobster eyes starting out of his head. Damn, sir, the woman's a born idiot. Apostrophe, apostrophe, and the ruined man. How does he pass the hours, alone? Let him remember it in that room, years to come. Apostrophe, apostrophe, he did remember it. It was heavy on his mind now, heavier than all the rest. Let him remember it in that room, years to come. The rain that falls upon the roof, the wind that mourns outside the door, may have foreknowledge in their melancholy sound. Let him remember it in that room, years to come. Apostrophe, apostrophe, he did remember it. In the miserable night he thought of it. In the dreary day, the wretched dawn, the ghostly, memory-haunted twilight. He did remember it. In agony, in sorrow, in remorse, in despair. Papa, Papa, speak to me, dear Papa. Apostrophe, he heard the words again, and saw the face. He saw it fall upon the trembling hands, and heard the one prolonged low cry go upward. He was fallen, never to be raised up any more. For the night of his worldly ruin there was no tomorrow's sun. For the stain of his domestic shame there was no purification. Nothing, thank heaven, could bring his dead child back to life. But that which he might have made so different in all the past which might have made the past itself so different, though this he hardly thought of now, that which was his own work, that which he could so easily have wrought into a blessing, and had set himself, so steadily for years, to form into a curse. That was the sharp grief of his soul. Oh! He did remember it. The rain that fell upon the roof, the wind that mourned outside the door that night, had had foreknowledge in their melancholy sound. He knew, now, what he had done. He knew, now, that he had called down that upon his head, which bowed it lower than the heaviest stroke of fortune. He knew, now, what it was to be rejected and deserted. Now, when every loving blossom he had withered in his innocent daughter's heart was snowing down in ashes on him. He thought of her, as she had been that night, when he and his bride came home. He thought of her as she had been, in all the home events of the abandoned house. He thought, now, that of all around him, she alone had never changed. His boy had faded into dust, his proud wife had sunk into a polluted creature, his flatterer and friend had been transformed into the worst of villains, his riches had melted away, the very walls that sheltered him looked on him as a stranger, she alone had turned the same mild gentle look upon him always. Yes, to the latest and the last. She had never changed to him, nor had he ever changed to her, and she was lost. As, one by one, they fell away before his mind, his baby hope, his wife, his friend, his fortune, oh how the mist, through which he had seen her, cleared, and showed him her true self. Oh, how much better than this, that he had loved her as he had his boy, and lost her as he had his boy, and laid them in their early grave together. In his pride, for he was proud, yet he let the world go from him freely. As it fell away, he shook it off. Whether he imagined its face as expressing pity for him, or indifference to him, he shunned it alike. It was in the same degree to be avoided, in either aspect. He had no idea of any one companion in his misery, but the one he had driven away. What he would have said to her, or what consolation submitted to receive from her, he never pictured to himself. But he always knew she would have been true to him, if he had suffered her. He always knew she would have loved him better now than at any other time. He was as certain that it was in her nature as he was that there was a sky above him, and he sat thinking so, in his loneliness, from hour to hour. Day after day uttered this speech. Night after night showed him this knowledge. It began, beyond all doubt, however slow it advanced for some time, in the receipt of her young husband's letter, and the certainty that she was gone. And yet so proud he was in his ruin, or so reminiscent of her only as something that might have been his, but was lost beyond redemption, that if he could have heard her voice in an adjoining room, he would not have gone to her. If he could have seen her in the street, and she had done no more than look at him as she had been used to look, he would have passed on with his old cold unforgiving face, and not addressed her, or relaxed it, though his heart should have broken soon afterwards. However turbulent his thoughts, or harsh his anger had been, at first, concerning her marriage, or her husband, that was all past now. He chiefly thought of what might have been, and what was not. What was all summed up in this. That she was lost, and he bowed down with sorrow and remorse. And now he felt that he had had two children born to him in that house, and that between him and the bare white empty walls there was a tie, mournful, but hard to rend asunder, connected with a double childhood, and a double loss. He had thought to leave the house knowing he must go, not knowing whither upon the evening of the day on which this feeling first struck root in his breast, but he resolved to stay another night, and in the night, to ramble through the rooms once more. He came out of his solitude, when it was the dead of night, and with a candle in his hand went softly up the stairs. Of all the footmarks there, making them as common as the common street, there was not one, he thought, but it seemed at the time, to set itself upon his brain, while he had kept close, listening. He looked at their number, and their hurry, and contention foot treading foot out, and upward track and downward jostling one another and thought, with absolute dread and wonder, how much he must have suffered during that trial, and what a changed man he had cause to be. He thought, besides, oh, was there, somewhere in the world, a light footstep that might have worn out in a moment half those marks, and bent his head, and wept as he went up. He almost saw it, going on before. He stopped, looking up towards the skylight, and a figure, childish itself, but carrying a child, and singing as it went, seemed to be there again. Anon, it was the same figure, alone, stopping for an instant, with suspended breath, the bright hair clustering loosely round its tearful face, and looking back at him. He wandered through the rooms, lately so luxurious, now so bare and dismal and so changed, apparently, even in their shape and size. The press of footsteps was as thick here, and the same consideration of the suffering he had had perplexed and terrified him. He began to fear that all this intricacy in his brain would drive him mad, and that his thoughts already lost coherence as the footprints did, and were pieced onto one another, with the same trackless involutions, and varieties of indistinct shapes. He did not so much as know in which of these rooms she had lived, when she was alone. He was glad to leave them, and go wandering higher up. Abundance of associations were here, connected with his false wife, his false friend and servant, his false grounds of pride. But he put them all by now, and only recalled miserably, weakly, fondly, his two children. Everywhere, the footsteps. They had had no respect for the old room high up, where the little bed had been. He could hardly find a clear space there, to throw himself down, on the floor, against the wall. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.